Happy Friday, everybody. Pardon me. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, frog in throat and all, Michael Cutler. It is August the 29th. We are staring down the barrel of the Labor Day weekend, and boy, is labor taking it in the neck or perhaps somewhere else with everything going on. But I thank you so much for joining me this evening. Hope you've all had a great week. Hope you're all looking forward to a fun-filled weekend wherever you may be. And I hope somebody paid the weather bill so you have sunny skies and great weather to enjoy. There is so much going on today. I expect my good friend Lauren Martell will be joining me in a little bit. But I want to start out by reminding you that I'm a retired senior special agent of what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Ever since the terror attacks of 9/11, I have done everything in my power to get a message out there, both to our fellow Americans and to our alleged political leaders. And boy, oh boy, I use that term leader advisedly. There are precious few to be found. It seems as though most of the people in positions of authority are really children wearing suits. I don't know any other way to describe this current collection of flotsam and jetsam that occupy these lofty offices on both sides of the aisle. You know, it's not about left or right, folks, but it's about right or wrong, and it's about putting America and Americans first. Wouldn't that be something to see? But in any event, there's a couple of websites I would very much like for you to visit. Please go to capsweb.org, C-A-P-S, and that, of course, is Californians for Population Stabilization. My good friends out on the West Coast in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara, California. And, of course, my own personal website, Michael Cutler, C-U-T-L-E-R, michaelcutler.net. And I've also been writing for Front Page Magazine, the David Horowitz Freedom Center magazine, something I'm very proud to be a columnist with. I'm writing for American Currency Magazine, which is a publication of the Washington Times, founded, I might add, American Currency, that is, founded by Dr. Ben Carson and edited by my friend Armstrong Williams, radio talk show host, media entrepreneur, and I will be joining Armstrong in South Carolina next week, next Monday. We're flying in, I think, on Sunday, but they're making the arrangements, so they'll tell me when I'm going. But it's going to be a town hall meeting right outside Myrtle Beach. I'm very much looking forward to it. Just got back 2 days ago from a whirlwind one-day trip to Atlanta, Georgia with the Tea Party, where I was interviewed for a documentary that they're working on. I'll be speaking at some more Tea Party events around the country, around the Northeast at least, down to Washington for a couple of speaking engagements. So I'm trying to get the message out there, and that's the purpose for this program. The program's mission statement, if you will, is to wake our people up as to the true significance of our borders, our immigration laws, not about being nativist or xenophobic, but about demonstrating common sense and demonstrating that compassion should at least as much apply to Americans as the open border anarchists would have us believe it should apply to people from other countries. Pardon me. Wow. You know, what we have to understand is that no rational family would give money to charity if their own children were going to bed hungry at night. And in point of fact, so many American kids are going to bed hungry at night. It's now estimated that 1 in 5 or maybe 1 in 4 American children are now living in families that are below the poverty line. This is an astonishing number. And yet, whenever we hear about immigration and you say, well, look, let's take care of Americans, oh, wait a minute, where is your compassion? Well, my compassion is here with our fellow Americans, irrespective of race, irrespective of religion, irrespective of ethnicity. We are a country. And countrymen and women take care of their own first. And that really is what our immigration laws are about. Let me just grab a cup of tea. Maybe I can dislodge Kermit the Frog, who seems to have been setting up shop in my throat tonight. You know, we are at risk of a terror attack Great Britain just up their security rating from 3 to 4. 5 is the highest level of preparedness, highest level of concern. It would appear that they are greatly concerned that with ISIS or ISIL, depending on what letters you want to use, that this Islamic State that they are creating in the Middle East, because of one foul up after another, I would say, by our own government in dealing with Iraq and dealing with a bunch of issues out there, pose an existential threat, not just to our friends in the Middle East, bad enough, but right here at home to the United States and our allies closer to home. We've got to get our act together. We have the president saying that he has no strategy. No strategy. Wow. I mean, wow. We went to the cupboard. We found it was bare. We're fresh out of strategy, but maybe if you come back next week, we'll have a shipment come in. I want someone to explain to me how the commander-in-chief of the superpower United States of America could stand in front of the TV cameras and microphones and say, we don't have a strategy, but we're working on it. My dog ate my homework. I guess the White House dog ate the president's strategy. Isn't it remarkable how the president's handicap seems to have become America's handicap? He's on the golf course, and here we are trying to find out what in the world we're supposed to do to protect ourselves. 9/11 rapidly approaching, the threats from ISIS getting louder and louder. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the Secretary of Defense go on national television, and they say these people are serious, they're loaded for bear, they pose a threat. 2 days later, they go back on the air and said, well, maybe not so much. I think somebody got a phone call, but that's for you to think about. That's for all of us to think about. We know what damage Al-Qaeda did to us. We know what the 9/11 Commission had to say about Al-Qaeda, what the 9/11 Commission had to say about the role of immigration and border security and national security. And meanwhile, we have an administration and members of both political parties who don't get it, perhaps don't want to get it. It's just so impossible for me as a rational human being to begin to try to fathom what in the world we're hearing from these people. These people, of course, being our supposed leaders. They talk about providing lawful status to unknown millions of illegal aliens. I mean, I just want you to think about that. How in the world do you protect your country when you have open borders and millions of people wandering around the United States, and there's an absolute disregard for our immigration laws or our borders? And I'm not just talking about the illegal aliens. I'm talking about the President of the United States. And let's be very blunt about it. I'm also talking about the politicians from both sides of the aisle. You know, people say to me, well, Governor Perry finally gets it. He said, we got to secure the border. The terrorists are coming across the border. Well, Governor Perry, if you're listening to me, and you probably aren't, but who knows, or if somebody who knows Governor Perry is listening, here's what we need to understand. I'm not much of an athlete. I have some friends who, when I was growing up, were great ball players, not me, except for handball. That's the quintessential Brooklyn sport. But in baseball, they put outfielders out there so that if anybody hits the ball over the infielder's heads, you don't get it in the park home run. For immigration, for border security, interior enforcement is the outfield. Aliens are going to get past those inspectors at ports of entry, and they will be up to no good. Aliens will ultimately get past the Border Patrol. It's inevitable. So what's the plan B? If we go along with the wacky ideas of Governor Perry and all these other people, I mean, think of all the people that would be the next president given their opportunity. How many of them are willing to provide lawful status to millions of illegal aliens who are not only undocumented, which is bad enough, it means that they don't have official identity documents or perhaps they don't want to show them to you, but they're uninspected. And they think that the solution is to give these people identity documents and lawful status. It's bizarre. This encourages more illegal immigration, and any such program would not only violate the 9/11 Commission findings, but it violates common sense. You don't go around telling people there's too many of you guys for us to deal with, so if we find you, we'll give you a green card, and now the debate is whether you get a green card or citizenship. This is madness, and we've heard it from Perry, we've heard it from Rubio, we've heard it from everybody, and it's got to stop. The words have to stop, and the intention behind those words have to stop. I see Lauren Martell is on, so well, let's bring Lauren on.
Hey,
Lauren
good
Martell,
evening, Michael.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you as well.
Thank you so much for joining me.
I cut the monthly Hilton Head Island Bar Association bar party just to be on your show because I think the issues are so important.
Wow, now I am honored. When a good-looking
yes.
blonde walks away from a bar party to get on my radio program, what more can I want?
Well, you know, it's because one of the reasons is part of your topic actually leads into my alma mater, which was Syracuse University. And I was actually attending law school when Pan Am Flight 103 went down. So
okay.
your topic of interest today has a personal note for me today.
You know, it's funny. I will never forget when that happened. I remember I was on my way into the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel, the tunnel that separates Brooklyn from Manhattan. And there was a news bulletin, and the guy sitting in the car next to me going into the tunnel started beating up his steering wheel. And I had to wonder if maybe this poor guy had a family member or a friend on that airplane. He started screaming. I could see him screaming in his car and punching the steering wheel.
Wow. Well, it's possible. I mean, a lot of people were affected by that. And so, of
course, my goodness, yes.
With that in place, you know, that set a ban. And so it's highly unusual that they would even be discussing, you know, lifting that in this climate where we haven't really figured out Benghazi.
Right. And what Lauren is talking about, and we hadn't quite gotten to it yet, You're two steps ahead of me, but not surprisingly. with everything else going on, the president, by the way, and I'm writing an article for Caps about this because Senator Grassley, who's one of the few heroes on the Hill, along with Senator Jeff Sessions, my good friend Lou Barletta, Steve King, Senator David Vitter, there are some good people. But Chuck Grassley is in a state of rage, as we all should be, that the administration is releasing hundreds of criminal aliens, including 100-odd aliens who had been convicted of homicides, murder. Unbelievable. American safety isn't an issue. The well-being of American citizens isn't even an afterthought. And now the President of the United States has come out and said, we should allow people from Libya to come to America and learn how to fly airplanes. We should allow physics students from Libya to come to the United States and learn nuclear physics. We do have already engineering students in the United States from Iran, the country that we're trying to prevent from getting nuclear weapons. So on the one hand, we hear this great stuff, wow, nuclear nonproliferation. We're going to stop it. We're going to make the world secure. On the other hand, we're trying to train the people that want to kill us. You know, look at the story about that woman, Siddiqui, who had gotten her degrees here in the United States on a scholarship at MIT and Brandeis University, two of the most prestigious of the colleges, scholarship. Got a PhD in biology and neurology. She's a brilliant chemist, perhaps deranged, but brilliant, and there's a thin line, I guess, between genius and flat-out crazy. But this is a woman who wanted to carry out an attack against the United States, allegedly, grabbed a gun and tried to shoot some of our soldiers in Iraq. And now it turns out that when ISIS grabbed Jim Foley, the journalist who was ultimately beheaded in one of the most dastardly, disgusting, despicable acts I could imagine, that the original game plan, according to an email or letter that had been sent to Jim Foley's parents and family members, was they had wanted to swap him for Siddiqui because she's now doing for all intents and purposes, life for having tried to kill American soldiers overseas. So think about what we're doing. We take people who want to kill us,
well,
and we educate
yeah.
them. We educate
yes,
them.
And then we arm them. We educate
and we
them.
And we arm them.
We arm them.
And, it's
and
not just
we
educate
give
them
extra, them. We give them walking around money.
Listen,
really.
I wouldn't mind if they were teaching her poetry. I mean, they're teaching her how to build chemical weapons in those college classes where she got her PhD. This isn't a game.
Right.
You know, I still remember getting that phone call 6 months to the day after 9/11. I just had an argument with my then-Congressman Anthony Weiner. That I was pulling into my driveway, and as I was pulling in, I got a phone call, and I grabbed my cell phone, and it wasn't a smartphone back then. This was in 2002. It was a dopey phone. And the phone rings, and it was the minority counsel in the Immigration Subcommittee telling me that two of the dead terrorists had just been granted authorization to attend flight school 6 months after the attack. So the whole world knew that Mohammed Atta and Marwan al-Shehhi, the two dirtbags in question, they knew they were dead. They knew they'd been terrorists. But that didn't stop the Immigration Service. No siree. They gave them authorization to go to flight school. And when I heard it, I almost smacked into the tree in front of my house. I was so startled. And I wound up testifying at that hearing that was called by the House Judiciary Committee. And you know what's amazing, Lauren? And I think you have the link. If you don't, I'll send it to you. And if you folks go to my website, michaelcutler.net, or you can read my articles at Front Page Magazine or capsweb.org, watch the hearing. It's 2 hours. It's worth the time. You won't get to see much of me, which is a relief. I just provided prepared testimony and answered one or two questions. But watch what then-Commissioner Ziegler, the guy in charge of immigration, had to say. Listen to what Geers, the chairman of the Immigration Subcommittee, had to say. We must never again allow terrorists in, and if they come in, we're going to track them down, we're going to hunt them down, we're going to find them, we're going to arrest them, we're going to deport them, we're going to imprison them, we're going to make America safe. And Ziegler's there going, yep, we're going to do this by such and such date, that by this date, that by this date. And the furthest out he said they would need to do most of what they were talking about was maybe a year later, at the most, but probably just months away. Well, here we are coming up on the 13th anniversary of 9/11. And most of what they talked about has yet to be accomplished. It took us 44 months to win the Second World War. And then we get this, you know, oh, we're going to secure the border. And have you read the legislation about that, Lauren Martell, what they call securing the border, what it means to them? See, in the Twilight Zone, in the fantasy zone, where these knuckleheads and wackaloons that call themselves Congress live, they have a different concept
of
border security.
Well, they call their legislation things like DREAM Act. So it really isn't placed in reality much anyway.
No. 90% operational control over the high traffic areas to be verified within 5 years. What does that mean?
Well,
what does that
know,
mean?
Michael, that's right. And I have something else to ask you what it means, too. But also just going back to just the art of war. And, you know, anybody who wants to function on any sort of basic level in understanding what it means to, you know, be secure and to have a prosperous society that's functioning in a functional manner, not a, you know, dysfunctional or malfunctioning manner, would read The Art of War by Sun Tzu. And clearly Americans should be reading that right now, too, since it is a Chinese, you know, ancient Chinese book of warfare.
Yeah,
but one of the things that's really clear is that you don't want to have prolonged war, and the extra bonus of the art of war is to win against your enemy without ever having to draw your own sword. And prolonged war actually helps that. And America has truly become really vulnerable and has not really, the American people, we feel it a little bit. You know, we see glimmers of it, but we still have not consciously become aware of just how vulnerable we are and just how in jeopardy we have really allowed ourselves. And it isn't anything that our enemies have done in a kinetic theater kind of way. It's really a subtle and insidious infiltration that's changed the rules. And, you know, here's one thing that, just like you said about what does this really mean, is the Department of Homeland Security spokesman is S.Y. Lee, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it says the United States is committed to working with Libya to build its sovereign institutions and are working closely with the government to bring stability to Libya, said DHS spokesman S.Y. Lee. As part of the effort, the U.S. is reviewing. Sorry, my niece just came in. I think she's listening to something on her little iPad. The U.S. is reviewing U.S. policies that have been in place since before Libyan revolution to see how they might be updated to better align with U.S. interests while maintaining the highest standards of security. And so, Michael Cutler, my friend and expert in this area, what does that even mean?
And now let's give it some context. How do you say Benghazi? Which, for those of you who are not aware of it, Benghazi is in Libya. So, I mean, think about what happened at our embassy. Think about what an absolute disaster that was and the nonsense that followed. It was a terrorist attack. No, it wasn't. It was a bad movie review, you know. They didn't like the film, or maybe it was the popcorn. I don't know. It was a terrorist attack. It was a terrorist attack. And I'm not being partisan. You know, I know you're a conservative. I'm a Democrat. This isn't about left or right. But when you sit there getting bamboozled, first we got bamboozled by Bush. I referred to it as being bushwhacked. And now we're getting hammered by Obama and his fantasies. I mean, fantasies. I don't know any other way of describing what his news conferences have become, what the press releases are. They are not grounded in reality. I think you would have found more honest reporting in Pravda and Izvestia under the old Soviet Union than we're getting out of the White House or the Labor Department or our own government. When they can talk
that
about
would
it...
Be, that would be
am
hysterically
I wrong?
Funny. No, I mean, that would be hysterically funny if it wasn't so true. And that's exactly what we've, as the American people, have been fed is propaganda. And it really is going to be up to American people individually to educate themselves on these issues and then dig deep into what common sense really says. Because, you know, now we have, what is it, over a million foreign students on these H-1B visas over here.
Yep.
That's
yep.
enough right there. So there's no real reason for Obama to be saying, let's bring over some more when, you know, our own American students are struggling to, you know, get into college, have jobs when they get out of college.
Think of the national security risk. And here's something that's such a disconnect, Lauren. How many times, I want all you folks out there to listen carefully to these politicians. We hear all these little pat phrases and we come to accept them as, oh, it's the truth. I mean, you know, when I travel around the country, people say, well, they say, or I've heard. What reliable sources those are, they say and I've heard. So one of the I've heard that the American schools aren't good enough to really train engineers or scientists anymore. So until the schools are better, because we all know that the teachers are all evil and they're trying to screw the kids up. I mean, there are good teachers, there are bad teachers. There are some very dedicated teachers. But we're being told, oh, the American schools stink, they rot, they're incapable of training anybody. Then you read the articles that say, no, in fact, the Brookings Institution just put out a report earlier today that the United States is, I believe, the number one place for students from other countries looking to study abroad. They want to come here. And what do they want to study here? The STEM classes, science, technology, engineering, math. And then the same politicians who tell us that our schools are so messed up that we need to bring in the best and brightest from elsewhere because we're just a bunch of idiots. Think of Ted Cruz and his statements. Then they turn around and say, well, but we need to staple a green card onto the diploma of the foreign students who study here. And you sit there saying, well, wait a minute. Why would you want to give a green card to an alien who went to a defective school so the education's probably next to worthless? But that's not what they say. Oh, these kids that came from overseas, they're brilliant. They're fabulous. They're all going to discover the way to make warp drive happen. They're going to discover the cure to aging and cancer and Alzheimer's disease. They're brilliant because we trained them. We need to keep them here. Well, wait a minute. If the schools can't turn American kids into engineers and scientists worth hiring, what's magical about foreign students? And I'm going to tell you what's magical. The only thing extraordinary about foreign workers is they work for extraordinary low wages under extraordinarily adverse conditions with lousy benefits. So this is about driving down the wages, but people don't seem to understand it. You know, George Orwell had a couple of great quotes. One of them, it seems really apt right now, in a time of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. We've all gotten the point that we see these guys in front of the TV and their noses are growing. Did you know you can use your television as a lie detector, by the way?
No.
Turn it on, and if there's a politician standing in front of the camera, he's lying.
That's a good litmus test.
When do we get the truth, and how do we get the truth? And look at the news reporting agencies. There's a guy on a network that should be telling the truth. We expect them to. Then he says, well, you know, it was like Chicken Little. The deficit's going up. Instead of the sky is falling, the deficit's going up. And this is the same economic journalist who keeps on insisting that comprehensive reform is the cure. How is it the cure if you go to the UN or the World Bank website? It's right there, right on the very beginning. Passage of comprehensive reform would increase the money being wired out of the United States.
That's right.
Do we
really think that's
going to help us?
You hit the, you know, out of the eight, you know, heads of Medusa, that's probably the most core one that you just discussed right there is really the banking industry and, you know, sort of flattening the playing field and the global.
Do you have a mortgage on your house, Laura?
Yeah.
Okay. Can I ask you a question? Have you ever called up the bank and asked them to mow their half of the lawn or paint their half of your house?
Well, right.
Harry Truman said bankers are no one's friend. They only lend you money when you can prove you didn't need it in the first place. And I just never knew that three-card Monty was a product. I mean, how many times have you heard banks saying, we have a product? I didn't know that a scam was a product. Half of what they sell us, quote-unquote, is snake oil and scams.
Right,
and yet they get away with it because they're in the pockets of the politicians. Look at the banks that get nailed for moving money, and we're talking billions. There was an article, I forget if it was U.S. News and World Report or Newsweek, but one of those magazines several months ago had an article, and the title was really amazing. It was "Too Big to Jail," that nobody in the banking industry goes to jail for moving drug money, it seems. They just give the government whatever fine, $8 billion, $9 billion, $5 billion. They got the money stockpiled. It's the cost of doing business. It's their rainy day fund. Oops, it's raining. Let me get my umbrella and let me get my checkbook. Obama's got his phone and his pen. They've got an umbrella and a checkbook. It's raining, so we'll write a check and the big bad feds will go away. And meanwhile, where's the money going? It's going into the pockets of the cartels, into terrorist organizations. But no one goes to jail because the banks write the check and it's over.
Well, that's right. And that brings me to my next point on accountability in America and how, you know, the system is supposed to work and how it actually is working in reality. And we talk about, you know, how many students we now have over here on these visas. And it looks like they have the Department of Homeland Security was created in 2003, right?
Right.
And basically, it's got the Customs Service and the Immigration and Naturalization Service. And
the GSA police, all folded in. I mean, if you want to talk about a bureaucratic leviathan, in fact, if you go to Front Page Magazine, they have one of my articles posted, my latest article, Reforming the Department of Homeland Surrender, as I have come to call it, and I provided some background into this. You know, I did a bunch of congressional hearings about it, and I came to refer to this process because they put customs people in charge of most of the immigration area, and they have no knowledge or inclination, many of them, to even be bothered with immigration. It was done intentionally. This was designed to fail. Rube Goldberg, organizational plan for DHS. I'm convinced they dug Rube Goldberg up, gave him a crayon, and said, have at it. So they create this monstrosity. And you know what I called it? I called it the customization of immigration law enforcement.
Well, and that would be great if that even, like, made, if the definition of those words were actually applicable to what, you know, they were doing. But,
no, what I mean by customization, it's with the orientation towards customs. So you have precious few agents, and most of the agents that they need to be enforcing the immigration law are chasing counterfeit Gucci wallets. Now, you tell me what's the bigger threat, phony Gucci wallet or Gucci handbag or a phony passport.
Right. Well, now tell me, because we've in our immigration system now, they've diluted it so much that you don't have to have a face-to-face interview. So how are they, even with these, you know, and 20,000 employees, it sounds like a lot, but it really isn't that much. They've got offices in all 50 states and then 47 countries, they say. I don't know why we need to have DHS in 47 countries exactly.
We do. They're very important. They function, let me just stop you. They function like legal attachés. So the idea is that if we need information about individuals that are in our custody or that we're investigating, that they are in the country that these folks came from so they can quickly get the information and the intelligence we need. They're vital to us. As long as they do the job properly, we absolutely need them.
So we've got one in Libya, right? Or probably two, maybe, hopefully.
Hopefully.
Now,
if not ISIS, certainly the FBI should have their legats there, yes. And State Department works with us as well.
So how is the system supposed to work on catching up with, we all know that the terrorists that took down the Twin Towers and created such havoc on September 11th of 2001 were on H-1B visas and were here, you know, doing some flight school and things like that.
I don't think they were on H-1Bs. I'd have to go back into my notes, but some were on student visas, some had come as tourists, some had gotten temporary lawful status. You know, and here's the point also. If you remember Massawi, the 20th hijacker, as a citizen of France, he didn't need a visa to come here. Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, because of his planting bombs in the shoes, and I know my friends out at CAPS always joke about this, because I haven't made this point in a while, but if you look at the shoe bomber and you look at the picture of Richard Reed, if that guy doesn't look certifiable, I don't know what does. I can't imagine that even with the foolishness that goes on with State Department, that they would have given him a visa. But the fact that he could get on the airplane without a visa was utterly ignored, but they were willing to learn the lesson that you can conceal explosives in your shoes, and that's why we take our shoes off. So when we inconvenience Americans, no biggie. When we inconvenience foreign visitors, very big. That's why the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has created something known as the Discover America Partnership to try to convince foreign visitors to come to America so they can grab them by their ankles and shake them until their pockets are empty. So I want you to think about something. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce has partnered with the hotel, hospitality, and travel industries to convince our government to expand the visa waiver program. So on 9/11, we had 26 visa waiver countries. As of a couple of months ago, Chile became number 38. Isn't it reassuring to know that people responsible for room service are now making national security decisions for the United States?
Well, it's insane. I mean, you know, I've never flown a plane before, and so you wouldn't want me to be creating all the flight plans for, you know, the airline.
But it's worse than that. It's not that they're inept. It's they have an agenda. They know that if they can get more people to come here, they can make more money. If they can take down border security so more people come, they make more money. When I testified before the House Immigration Subcommittee, they had a nitwit from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce as one of the witnesses. And the members of Congress had to go cast a vote on the Hill, so they called for a recess. So while we were in recess, I walked over to this guy from the Chamber of Commerce, and I said, do you understand how dangerous this all is? And he was making these ridiculous statements that have nothing to do with reality. If we could let in lots more workers, American wages would go through the roof. And I'm thinking, are you kidding me? How does that work? Supply and demand says that if you dump a commodity into the market, the price of the commodity drops. That's why the De Beers Company, famous for diamonds, tightly controls the release of gem-quality diamonds to make certain that they don't flood the market and drive down the price. But it was lie after lie, and he finally said to me, Mr. Cutler, don't you understand that those borders that you're so excited about are an impediment to wealth? I said,
well,
they're an impediment to people
though.
Who want to kill us, too.
Well, that's right. If it were just about money, it might not be that big of a deal, but in your opinion, you know, are some of the people that potentially are coming through the border or coming through these visa programs now, they don't really care about money. Maybe their agenda is something else. Are there other agendas out there that we should be aware of?
But here's the point, yeah. But our government is acceding to the demands that are greed-driven. And the bad guys are seeing in that foolishness opportunity. Remember what the communists said. The capitalists will sell you the rope with which you will hang them. I believe it was Lenin who said that. The capitalists will sell you the rope with which you will hang them. So here we have this guy who's basically a rope salesman.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's saying, if we could take down the borders and get lots more people here, it will create wealth for whom? It will create wealth because it will drive down wages so the people at the top of the food chain, not the millionaires so much, but the billionaires make more money that way. The banks will be moving more money out of the United States, and they're the silent partner. I want you to think of the banks in a unique way today, folks. Think of the banks as being not unlike a moving company. If, for argument's sake, I go to South Carolina and I have such a great time when I'm out there with Armstrong Williams, and I hope you'll be there at that event also. And I say, you know what, I'm going to move to South Carolina. So I call up Allied Van Lines or some other moving company, and I say, look, I have a house, I'm selling it, I'm taking my furniture, and I'm moving to South Carolina. So the person on the other end of the phone says, okay, Mr. Cutler, how many pieces of furniture? They don't care if it's Scandinavian, French Provincial, Italian. They don't care. It's how many pieces of furniture, how far are you going? Are you moving from a private house to an apartment house or two private houses? Do we have to deal with elevators or not? Because they're looking to see how they're going to compute the cost. They don't care if it's good furniture, bad furniture, and good taste or lousy taste. All they care, how many pieces of furniture, how far are we going with it, so I know how much to charge you. The banks don't care how the money was obtained. They don't care if the money is the money being wired back home by a prostitute who's working in a massage parlor having sex with 20 men a night. They don't care if it's money that was the result of a drug deal. They don't care if it's the money that resulted from a kidnapping. They don't care if it's because a surgeon was paid money to save a child's life. They don't care. All they know is how much money. Where is it going from and where is it going to? They are a moving company. And the more money that drains out of the U.S. economy, the more money that they get to move, so the more money that they get to make. And they don't care about what they consider to be collateral damage, the destruction of America, or the crimes that were committed to enable the people moving the money to get their hands on that money. How's that for an analogy?
It's great. I mean, that really is, especially the French provincial furniture and the Italian furniture.
I've been a resident court, I can tell.
Yeah, that's good.
Now, there's something else to think about.
How...
I just want to make one other point.
Yeah.
We've been watching, and I've done a lot of radio programs, and I've been on Newsmax lately. In fact, I'm working on an article for Newsmax magazine. I hope to write for them regularly. We'll see how things work out. But when I was on with J.D. Hayworth, we were talking about this impact, and also One American News Network. Those two upstart TV networks are the best, the absolute best at getting the unmitigated truth out there. There's no games. There's no agenda. And so I'm happy to do their shows. And they do it by Skype, so it's nice and convenient. And as you might imagine, we've spent several months now looking at that onslaught of unaccompanied minors coming across the border. And we were looking how the Border Patrol has been slammed. They couldn't carry out their mission before this happened, so certainly dumping all this work in their lap and having the Border Patrol agents become concierge service for illegal aliens certainly doesn't help them do a better job of securing the border. But there's another part of the immigration system that I hadn't even been thinking about that is also getting hammered badly, and it's the immigration courts. There are hundreds of thousands of pending deportation cases right now. What the president did, because of the emergency, so-called, is to tell the courts, you're going to bump these unaccompanied minors up and let them displace ongoing cases. So you could have had a bank robber or a murderer or a drug dealer or a rapist. being in the middle of a deportation hearing, they yank his case, and that gets put on a back burner. He just got a reprieve. And why has he been given a reprieve? Because the priority is to process these unaccompanied minors. So aliens are waiting years to get an order of deportation.
It's incredible. It really is. And that's the system. I was going to ask you more about that, but now that you're on this,
we're on the same frequency. I called you today. You told me you were going to call me, so great minds think alike. But go ahead, Lauren.
Well, this particular issue is just of such interest to me because I see our systems. And, you know, we have the greatest judicial system in the whole world, and it's funded by taxpayers, you know. I mean, a lot of our court system and everything is really put up on the backs of our American citizens. And it was at one point that our court systems were there to enforce the law and to be fair and unbiased and to seek justice, you know. And when you have this kind of a situation occur, you're going to have miscarriages of justice over and over again.
Absolutely.
Puts the checks and balances out of whack. It puts our due process and our system that has been set up for the most fair and the most procedurally, you know, allocated due process system in the world at risk. And so basically we've got through a pinstroke of our president, without going through Congress or anything else really, is to say certain people now that aren't even citizens have priority, and that's taxpayer money. I mean, most Americans...
Well, wait a moment. This is the immigration courts where they wouldn't be citizens. If you're a citizen, you don't wind up in immigration court. This isn't the criminal justice system.
Right.
We're talking about the immigration court system.
Right, in the immigration court system. But they're still putting people out who have been in there through... They've been going through the process through the legal way, right? I mean, some of the people...
Let me backtrack so we're on the same page. I'm talking about aliens who are facing deportation.
Oh, right.
Okay. So what's happening is they're being put on the back burner so they can take care of the kids. There was a judge who was complaining, and I actually agree with this. So I was rebuffed by a conservative member of Congress. Oh, we can't appear weak. I said, you know, because of the Immigration Reform Act of 1996, And in fact, we had a voice in it, myself and several of my colleagues. We had meetings with the chief counsel for the subcommittee when the law was being written. And I disagree with this particular provision. We have cases where you might have somebody who's been living in the United States as a resident alien, here legally, for the last 28 years, let's say.
Yeah,
I'm pulling
that's
a number
what I'm
out
talking
of my
about,
ear.
Yeah.
And the guy is married, and he has children, and he's a successful businessman, and he says to his wife, you know, honey, it's been so long that I've been living in this country. I don't really feel ties with my home country anymore. I want to be an American. So he applies for citizenship, and they find out that back when he was in college 25 years ago, as a 19-year-old kid, he got grabbed with two joints in his back pocket. He's never been arrested since. It wasn't that he was selling it. It was personal use. I mean, two joints. And I'm not a fan of marijuana. I've never smoked that nonsense. I have no desire to go near that garbage. But, you know, being fair and reasonable. So here's a guy, a quarter of a century later, applies for citizenship, and there is no discretion. The judge now has to immediately put this guy into a deportation proceeding because of that change in law that happened in 96. So now somebody who may have a family here, came here legally, did something stupid one night back on college, is now facing deportation. He might be a doctor. He might own his own business. Doesn't matter. It's ironclad. And I said, you know, maybe there should be a little bit of discretion there, a little wiggle room. It's a one-time deal. It wasn't a crime of violence. It was victimless in the truest sense of the word. And here you are 25 years later. What are we accomplishing that's worthwhile by saying to this guy, you're now deported? And I don't see
right.
it as being – I mean, I hope I make sense to you. There's got to be some fairness.
You
People
do,
make
and
mistakes.
this is going to be one of those issues that I'm going to further research and maybe do a blog on because, you know, I'm working with some people that are doing America Informed and a couple other things,
yep.
too, and I want to get that out there and so do a little more research on that. But the two questions that I wanted to ask you, because you are an expert in these areas, is, one – How are we going to monitor these new and how the ones that are already here, the over a million, how are we going to monitor these students on campus? for example, let's say they enroll in college and then never go to classes and,
well,
you know,
I
you
got
go
a
to
better
a different
one.
State.
Supposing it's not even a college. There's 9,000 schools that are authorized to issue the I-20, which is the form that the school fills out to get the alien that visa to come here. And we know some of these schools don't even exist. You know, we're not dealing with, you know, 25 schools or 100 schools, and you say, okay, well, let's see, there's Princeton, and there's, you know, City University of New York, and there's Cal State and Caltech and MIT. No, no, no. I mean, we're talking about 9,000 schools, including trade schools, schools that teach English as a second language, schools that teach hairdressing, and schools that, I mean, crazy stuff. There's no way that we can even have an agent visit all the schools, so we don't know where the students are. Supposedly, the foreign student advisor at the college that the student attends keeps track of the student, but we don't even know if the schools are on the up and up because there's not more than 9,000 of them. So understand
so
the chaos
how,
that we're looking at.
Yeah, we're looking at chaos. I mean, how is that smart? I mean, in your
no,
opinion, as an expert?
No, it's deadly. It's deadly, and now let's remember again, we are educating some people who want to hurt us. We are bringing in competition for American kids that need the jobs and want to be successful. So you have American children, and they are not of any concern to either party, folks. I don't care about the Democrats or the Republicans. They don't care about us. We are speed bumps. We are less than a squirrel running across the road, and if you become roadkill, so be it. And if you think I'm kidding, you think about 9/11. 3,000 people were killed. That's roughly the same casualty count as occurred at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. And you would think they would say, oh, my God, we're going to make sure this doesn't happen again. Now, if you go to that hearing that was held back in 2002, that's the kind of things they said. But the words
right.
never match the deeds never match the words. And you know what that tells you? They don't care about Americans. And they're doing everything they can to flood the country with people from other countries to dilute our vote and our political voice. The concern is that as lackadaisical as we are, they want to bring in people who are even less likely to understand what the democratic traditions are, so they can rule this country with an iron fist. The Democratic Party hates the Americans. The Republican Party hates the average American. We are an impediment to wealth, just like our borders are. I have no use for either parties. And I know members of Congress who are true leaders. They really have hairy chests, so to speak. Because when you talk to them about it, and I have, well, the men, not the women. Don't get excited, Lauren.
Right.
But you know
no,
the
I mean,
point
no,
that
like,
I'm making.
The boys, yeah. Well, I know who you're talking about is Lou Barletta. The man's got he's got kahunas.
Doesn't he have kahunas? I mean, absolutely. I mean, Lou Barletta said to me, he said, Mike Cutler, he said, let me tell you something, and I love Lou. Lou is like family to me. When I testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee last year, I don't know if I told you, I brought my wife and son with me. I said, look, you've never been to a hearing. Why don't you come to Washington? At the rate that I'm going with the battles I've been fighting, this might well be the last time I get an invitation. And so we testified. But Lou made certain to take time out from a very busy day to take us to lunch at the Capitol Hill Club. He had his key staff members join us. And, you know, we have many conversations. In fact, I owe Lou a phone call going back into session again. And I said, you know, how do you deal with your own party? And he said, I always have one thought in the front of my mind. The party didn't send me to Washington. The people of my town in Hazleton, Pennsylvania, they sent me to Washington. You know who also told me that? Congressman Steve King. It was the people of my community that sent me here. They're the ones I have to represent.
I wish Trey Gowdy was saying that, you know, in the middle of all these things that he's got going on, you know. But at the end of the day, you know, Michael, what do you think the average American citizen can do to make a difference?
They can do a lot. You know, wherever I travel, and by the way, if any of you folks out there become aware of opportunities for speaking events, debates, panel discussions, whatever, let me know. I mean, I you know, have mouth will travel. I've been all over this magnificent country from Hawaii to Seattle to California, Arizona, Alabama, Indiana, you name it, I've been there. It's been a scenic tour. And people always come up and say the same thing to me. I'm just one person. And I say to them, okay, and so am I. Now, I mean, I have a little bit of an advantage because of 30 years of a very diverse experience, having been an immigration agent, inspected my assignments, having worked with the Drug Task Force, having desks at the FBI, DEA, ATF, working with foreign government. So I have a different perspective, which is why I get called as an expert witness. Certainly, you're not going to have the guy down the block going to Washington as an expert, but their voices are supposed to be heard. And I said, if you go to the park and you see these statues that were erected to commemorate what individuals did, individuals, because on a particular day in history, when it really counted, the person that that statue was erected to honor stood up and made all the difference in the world. History is written by individuals. If I say to you, World War II, yes, you may talk about the 6 million Jews, the 13 million human beings who were killed. You're going to talk about the countries. You might talk about Anne Frank because she wrote that amazing book. So of the 6 million Jews who were killed, that didn't mean much to people. I mean, the number does and doesn't. Stalin, speaking of the Second World War, made a statement, and Alan Dershowitz, the brilliant constitutional lawyer, gave a speech at a memorial service for the Holocaust survivors. My first wife died many years ago, tragically, of breast cancer. Her parents were in the concentration camps. So every year they would get tickets to the memorial service at Temple Emmanuel. And I went to these services with two of my boys, and Dershowitz spoke. And he was talking about the Holocaust. He was talking about other atrocities. And he said, you know, if you commit a murder in the United States or in any country on this planet today, for the most part, you're going to get caught and you're going to be brought to justice. If you commit a murder and you kill 2, 3, 5 people, the likelihood is good that with all the international cooperation that we get from most countries, you're going to get picked up and you're going to ultimately be made to face justice. But as the casualty numbers rise, the likelihood of getting away with it increases, not decreases. And he said, think of what Stalin had said. One death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic. So we always tend to remember the individuals, Anne Frank for her book, The Diary. Think about the leaders of the Second World War. There's only a handful of names, General MacArthur, Eisenhower, Patton, you know, Montgomery from Great Britain. You think of Winston Churchill. You think of FDR, Harry Truman, Albert Einstein, the team that put together the atom bomb of the Manhattan Project. How many people are we really talking about here? A couple of dozen people? So with everything that went on, with all the millions of people who died, when you start to talk about the Second World War, we come down to a couple dozen names. Same thing with the First World War. Same thing with the American Revolution or the Civil War. It's always just those few people that stood up and rose above the masses and demonstrated.
I think of Dietrich Bonhoeffer very much now. I have his CD, and I can't wait to listen to it. It's like 3 hours of all the things that he said when he stood up when nobody was standing up in World War II, when the concentration camps were at their – you know, beginning to really kick in. He said that when you see an injustice, it's important to take a stand. It's important to put the spoke in the wheel so that the wheel of injustice doesn't continue to keep running and running, you know. And
grinding everybody down under it. You're 100% right,
yeah.
And that takes courage. But understand
it
the
does.
Point. Understand mm-hmm. the point. You can either be a passive observer and then spend the rest of your life kicking yourself. You know, when my last day comes, and I hope it's a long time from now because I haven't aggravated my quota, but on that last day...
I have more people that make angry. I have more fights to start.
Absolutely. Listen, Lauren Martell, I got to tell you, I am proud of my friends and equally proud of my enemies because I've acquired them all for the right reasons.
Yes.
Think about that.
Yes.
But, you know, but the point that I make is on that last day, God willing, decades from now, I
right.
don't want to think woulda,
mm-hmm.
coulda, shoulda. That is not what
no,
I want to have
right.
running around in my brain my last day in this life. Woulda, coulda,
no.
shoulda. We have to stand up and get our voices heard. That's what we need to do, and we can do it. When people push you down, you fight back. This nonsense that when you're bullied, call for help, maybe not so much. My dad was a construction worker, and I used to get beat up because I was a scrawny kid. Really, in a strong wind, I had trouble not getting blown away. You'd not know it to look at my lard ass these days. But back
then,
I don't think your dad
would have said, "Hey, Michael, put some duct tape on your mouth and just be quiet and go over there because you don't want
to
be."
Oh no, my dad said to me,
"You're going
to a gym. You're going to work out. And you're going to learn how to box." He said, "Because you're going to wake up one day and I won't be here, and on that day,
that's
you better
him.
Be up for the game." And I will tell you,
he was a good dad.
My mom gave me the same message. Typical Jewish mother, she was scared to death. Don't get hurt, don't get hurt. But, you know, I went out there, I had a couple of fist fights, and the music stopped.
Right.
When people understand that you're not going to put up with their crap, it stops. My father told me that only I could teach people how, let me just make the point. My dad said to me that I would teach people how they should treat me. And he said, you do that by demonstrating what you're willing to accept. I remember one of the funniest stories I ever heard about my father. And it was quintessential my pop. He was a construction worker, a plumber, a tradesman, as he liked to proudly proclaim. Plumber by trade. And that meant a lot to him and to me. I don't think a tradesman is any less important than a lawyer or an accountant or a school teacher. America's a huge orchestra, and we all have an instrument to play. And tradesmen go through an extensive apprenticeship program. It's not different from going to college for 5 years or whatever the deal is. But, you know, my father was a real two-fisted character. And my mother told me that when she was pregnant and work was hard to come by, my father walked past his boss on a construction site, and he said to his boss, "Good morning." And the boss was an absolute flaming tailpipe, if you get my drift. And the boss said to my father, "F you." And my father laid him out. He just decked him.
Well, that's what people are supposed to, you know, we're not doormats. We weren't.
No, and my father said this to me about it. My mom told me he came home in the middle of the day. She said, "What happened?" And he told her the story. Mm-hmm. And he dumped a bucket of water on this buffoon. And he said to the foreman, "When this idiot wakes up, tell him not to bother firing me. I just quit. Nobody talks to me that way." And my mother said, "My God, what do we do about money?" And he said, "What do I do about my dignity as a man?"
Oh, wow. That is so powerful, Michael. That's why you are such a strong man. And my grandfather, from whom
I was named my dad's father, came from Russia. He was a Cossack in the Russian army. And from what I understand, he was another scrapper that you didn't want to get on the wrong end of. And he became an American citizen the first day of his eligibility. He insisted that they spoke English around the dinner table. And one day my father said they heard this big commotion in the backyard, and my grandfather was a tinsmith, a coppersmith, roofer. And there's my grandfather on top of a neighbor using the guy's face like a speed bag. And he knocked the guy's teeth out. And they pulled my grandpa off this guy, and they said, "Willie, what in the world happened? Why did you do that to the guy? Crazy Russian." He said, "I don't give a crap about being called crazy, but God damn it, I'm an American."
That's hysterical. That's really awesome. Hey, listen.
But you know, the point that
I
make is, I'm not saying engage in fisticuffs, but damn it, when people start this nonsense, "Oh, you're anti-immigrant, you're xenophobic," folks, I want you to listen to this and commit this to your memory. The laws that we want enforced not only tell us who to kick out and who to keep out, but who to admit. Under those laws, we admit more than a million lawful immigrants every year. We naturalize more than 500,000 new citizens every year. That's more than the rest of the world combined. If you favor enforcing the laws that are on the books, you're pro-immigrant. Because it's under those laws that people legally immigrate. What do you think the word legal immigrant means? Lawful immigrant, in accordance with the laws that I support. So if I support the laws that enable people to legally immigrate, it's a contradiction in terms and concept to then turn around and accuse me or anybody else who's supportive of the laws and accuse us of being anti-immigrant. It's a lie. It is a bullying tactic. And we've got to stand up. And when you hear this race charge nonsense, too many Americans take a step back and say, "Oh, I'm sorry. You misunderstood, but I apologize." You know, I did a debate, and I want to tell an anecdote to you, and then I don't know how much time you have, but I'm going to go a little bit long this evening, but because there's some other material I want to cover for the audience. But I only have two more minutes.
I will tell the story after
you leave. But is there something you want to talk about since you've come on? And I took you away from this bar party. My goodness gracious.
I know. Which was so fun. And you know what, Michael? I am going to look forward to I'm marking my calendar right now, and I'm going to try to make it up to your event in South Carolina. On September 8th. And,
yep.
You know, just days before, you know, the September 11th, and we're all going to pray that we have a very safe time in America. And
yes.
We just, you know, just ask that the hedges of protection still are around America during that time. And, you know, I'm going to take the time to drive wherever you are. I mean, even if it's 4 hours away, I just am so honored that you're going to come to South Carolina and try to educate people, and we'll try to, you know, get as many people to this group as we can. And, you know, it's amazing the work that you do. I sit back, and I'm actually just completely amazed when I see your emails that come out, the articles that you write, all the appearances that you make on even, you know, Fox News in the past, Lou Dobbs in the past, now these blog radio shows, which are a great way to get out the truth.
I'm going to be joining Armstrong Williams on his Wednesday program on Sirius XM, by the way, starting in another week and a half.
And see, that's amazing. And these are ways, these are avenues, and these are ways to get the truth out. And you set an example. But, I mean, and what I encourage anyone who's listening tonight and any of the audience that's going to continue to listen to it through archives and things like that, just that you do make a difference, and it's really important to get involved and to study this stuff. And Michael is probably the foremost expert in America right now. He's the man who's been in the trenches, who's been there for the 9/11 Commission report. And if you wanted to find a handbook on, for example, you know, if a car had an accident and the experts went in to try to say what went wrong and then how to prevent it from ever happening again, that's exactly what the 9/11 Commission report is. And
mm-hmm.
Michael is one of the top, you know, people who testified during that period of time. And we need to make sure that we understand it and then that our politicians and our representatives understand it, because they are literally doing the opposite. If anything, they've actually ignored that and created something new. And, again, I do reference that there are taxpayer dollars at work, because this is literally Americans' money that's funding it. And when you're starting to fund things that are either grossly negligent or putting people in jeopardy through allowing certain terrorists to come in, and we're not specifically pinpointing any particular one at this time, but the potential threat for it is right there in the 9/11 Commission report. And that's just got to stop. I mean, it's such a no-brainer to me, you know. And the bottom line is that the American people have been played by their emotions, and it can become an emotional issue because we all want to love people, right? We want to love foreigners, and we want to bring in people, and we want to, you know, do the right thing for the poor and the needy and all these kinds of things. But it's okay to have boundaries. You know, it's okay to have borders. And I think you really speak to that very well as an expert in these areas, because you've literally seen 30 years of what works and what doesn't work, right?
Absolutely. And I really appreciate the kind words. On 9/11, I can't even tell you what it was like, Lauren, you know, and just think about this. I had testified 4.5 years earlier before the House Immigration Subcommittee on the issue of visa fraud, benefit fraud, because of the 93 terrorist attacks. So it was known by everybody this was the vulnerability. Think of those disingenuous, lying politicians, forgive the redundancy for so many of them, who didn't connect the dots. Why didn't they connect the dots? I wanted to send these imbeciles a box of crayons. We did connect the dots. We did connect the dots. And, you know, what was so remarkable was I had had a major argument with a friend of mine who was a counsel on the subcommittee. And we're good friends. I haven't spoken to him in quite some time. He became an immigration judge. I think he's probably still on the bench. I hope he is, because I think he's very, very bright and very decent. But we had our share of arguments, and we knew each other well enough that the four-letter language flowed pretty freely when we got angry. And I was home. I had injured my leg executing arrest and search warrants with the FBI and the New York City Police Department, so I was home banged up. But my buddies on the job knew I was speaking to people on Capitol Hill, so they would call me up and say this is wrong and that's wrong, and they've expanded the visa waiver program. We don't have enough agents. We don't have the resources. We don't have the money. We can't do our job. We need more jail space, and on and on. And I would periodically call up the subcommittee just to pass along all the frustrations and say, please help us. And occasionally there'd be a hearing, and they'd say, look, we can plug you into a hearing. But that came after the 9/11 attack. But at this point, it was just a matter of keeping the subcommittee up to speed and the House Judiciary Committee up to speed. Well, on one particular evening, I remember it was a sunny day. It was kind of cool. My son was sleeping in the back. He was a baby at the time. And I'm driving along, and the counsel calls me up, and I said, okay, Art, what's going on? He said, you tell me. You called me. And I gave him my laundry list of complaints. And I said, you know, my phone's ringing off the hook. We have lots of agents who want to do a good job. And for those of you who say that you're conservative and think that the solution isn't government, you have a lot of very dedicated civil servants, folks. There's a big difference between the knuckleheads at the top of the food chain who are political appointees and the careerists who know the importance of the work they do, not unlike soldiers that go out there into harm's way. And they really are worthy of our support and everything else because they're trying to do the right thing. And I said,
that's right.
To him,
and I do want to take this opportunity to just say, God bless the American military and God bless America. And I have to go. Michael,
go.
I absolutely adore you. I am so, you know, just so proud to have all the work that you're doing and have you include me. And I'm looking forward to researching some of the stuff on the immigration course. And the premise that, you know, we're trying to eradicate our immigration, you know, system that we have right now just by overburdening it so that it actually crashes. I'm looking forward to doing some more research and really putting some articles out there about that, maybe even, you know, looking into that. So thank you for having me on your show. It's an honor.
My pleasure.
Always.
My pleasure.
And I am saving the date for when you come down to South Carolina.
Okay. I owe you a big hug. And thank you so much for the kind words.
All right. God bless. I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Be well. Have a great time. Have a good weekend. I'm going to stay on, folks, just to finish up a couple things I started to talk about. So, you know, here we are having this argument on the phone, and I finally got so mad I said to this guy, what the bleep is it going to take, another attack at the World Trade Center? And that's how the conversation ended. That argument, that conversation took place on Friday before 9/11. 5 days later, the towers came down. 5 days later, 3,000 people were obliterated. 5 days later, the world would never be the same. So here we are now. I'm looking at this disastrous situation because I keep thinking back to that conversation and the hearing I did and what 9/11 meant to New York. The ashes landed on us. My neighbors were out there screaming in the middle of the night. They didn't know where their wives, their children, their parents, their siblings were. They never saw them again. Some of my neighbors came trudging home covered with the dust that you've seen on TV from head to foot. But by around midnight, if people didn't get home, they weren't coming home. They weren't coming home. So many people literally had to walk all the way over the Brooklyn Bridge into Brooklyn. Some of them just kept on walking. It was very hard to get transportation. The cell phones were out. You couldn't call anybody. I can't even tell you what it was like to be here in New York City on that day. So it's very sobering. And we're going to lose our own country because we're cowardly about confronting people who bully us and lie to us. I did this debate, and there was a professor from Peru. And we got into this conversation where one of the members of the audience asked me, how do you do a background investigation on somebody from another country? And I said, you know, that's a brilliant question. Because that question cuts to the heart of the problem. If we don't have the cooperation of other countries, of other governments, we're handicapped. Because we don't know who we're dealing with. If we're dealing with countries such as France, Germany, Canada, Great Britain, I worked very closely with the Israeli National Police for 26 years, these countries were eager to help us, Australia, New Zealand. You asked, they answered. There it was, bang, on the spot. And I will tell you, by the way, that probably the Israelis were the fastest to react to my requests for assistance and information. America does not have a stronger ally or a better friend than the state of Israel. And I look at what's going on with our relationship, with America's relationship with Israel, and it breaks my heart and leaves me furious. But there's another call. Let me see who we have. Hang on one moment, folks. You're on with Michael Cutler. Who's calling? Hello. Well, I guess it's just somebody who wants to listen. Anything you want to say? Okay. So in any event, what we wind up happening is that people really need to understand is how we've got to stand up for ourselves and for the country, because it's infuriating to see what's now happening. The intimidation process where you try to have a conversation with people in the audience, and the people you're debating take to an intimidation tactic, and that's exactly where I was going with this conversation. You have an individual asking you, how do you do the background investigations? And I explained it, and I explained how Israel and Great Britain and Canada and all of our allies are quick to help us. But I said there are other countries that either are incapable of helping us or don't want to help us or are corrupt, so that for a few dollars anybody can buy a good conduct certificate. For a few more dollars, perhaps they'll shred your criminal arrest record, the fact that you've been in jail. In some countries, they may not want to have their criminals sent back to them. They don't want the drug dealers. They don't want the gang members. They don't want the rapists. So they say, hey, we don't know who this guy is. Have a nice day. So there's a number of problems that we face in trying to properly vet foreign nationals from the third world. The professor who I was debating, there were four of us on the debate, but I was sitting opposite this lady from Peru, and she said, well, you know, Mexico gives us 100% cooperation. And I said, well, not so much, because let's remember that in 2003, October, I believe it was, a gentleman by the name of Stephen McGraw had testified before the House Immigration Subcommittee on the issue of these Mexican matricular consulars, these Mexican identity documents that are being given out willy-nilly by the government of Mexico to their citizens in the United States who are illegally present. And in point of fact, we know that those cards have also wound up being issued to people from Middle Eastern countries, including Iran. I said, so Mexico is not that much of our friend. They only act in their own best interest, certainly not in America's best interest. How many times have we tried to extradite criminals who came from Mexico? And they don't want to cooperate. And her reaction was to say to me, your problem, Mr. Cutler, very pointedly, is you have a Eurocentric view of the world. And I was furious that it's so funny because so many people didn't catch on to what she was really saying. Eurocentric, what does that even mean? Well, what it meant was because my ancestors, my mother, my dad's parents came from Eastern Europe, somehow my view of the world wasn't worthy, didn't coincide with what she thought was valid. And by the way, the gentleman, Stephen McGraw, when he made that statement at that hearing, certainly knew what he was speaking about because at the time he was the director of intelligence for the FBI in Washington. And you know, so what I always discuss are fact-based issues. I will cite sections of law. I will provide you with concrete examples. It's not about, oh, it seems like this would be a good idea, or wouldn't that be nice, or wouldn't this be the right thing to do? To me, the right thing to do is to look out for our country and our fellow citizens first. Charity begins at home. But it was a nasty statement. And, you know, I immediately heard those words, and it was like being punched in the face. Your problem, she said, is that you have a Eurocentric view of the world. You know, and it was just so infuriating. And I said to her, I turned to her directly, got in her face, and said, how dare you? I said, that's a statement of bigotry and racism. In a million years, I wouldn't have said to her, well, what do you know? You come from Peru, lady. Because she did say she was from Peru. And I don't care what country you're from, that doesn't make you less valuable, less intelligent, or less worthy of respect. But apparently those words that came out of her mouth were indicative of how she felt, the hostility that she felt towards me because of my own family's ancestry. And people came up to me after that debate and said, wow, it was refreshing that you told her off. I said, look, I'm a fair guy. But when you could tell me that I have a problem and the problem is where my family came from, I don't know of a bigger statement of bigotry. I mean, imagine if I had said to her, you know what your problem is, lady? You're from Latin America. She probably would have blown a gasket, and she should have if I was that dumb or bigoted to say it. But of course I wouldn't say it because I don't believe it. But I'm convinced this woman truly believed what she was saying, and I think she probably also had had success in the past with shutting down debate by making statements like that to intimidate people, to put people on the defensive, where the instinct is to withdraw and say, okay, I'm sorry, and end the conversation. We got to stop doing that. We got to stop doing it. You know, we're not talking about having a fist fight, certainly not. But the First Amendment does talk about the right for peaceable assemblage, so we can have those debates and discussions and be very frank and very honest about what we think. And that's exactly what I did. I accused her of bigotry and racism, because I believe that in the bottom of my heart that that had to be behind that statement. How is it a problem to be from any part of this world? And for people, including professors and some attorneys who were present, it was a packed audience in this huge room, to come up to me and say, boy, wasn't that refreshing? And I said, well, you know, the problem is we've become accustomed that when someone throws a punch at us and hits us in the nose, that we apologize for daring to permit our nose to get in the way of their fist. We need to stop it. We need to make the politicians understand that we are smarter than they hoped we are. We need to do our homework. That's the whole point of going to my website and capsweb.org. I'm only one of many writers there. The same thing with Front Page Magazine. The same thing with American Currency Magazine. The same thing with Newsmax. Get your information from diverse sources. You know, the old joke is that in a divorce, there's three sides to the discussion, his, hers, and the truth. Where the news is concerned, the reporters inevitably and invariably bring their prejudice to the keyboard. They don't mean to do it, perhaps, but they do it because we see things through our past experiences. Our life experiences alter our perceptions because that becomes the prism through which we see the world. So it's vital to spend some time doing some research, spend some time reading. If we could harness the kind of enthusiasm you see at these tailgate parties when there's a football game, the guys that go out there and it's 5 degrees and they rip their shirts off and they have this elaborate body paint painted on their bare chests, and you think, wow, what spirit. I'd like to see that kind of effort, that kind of spirit, that kind of commitment, that kind of concern present and evident where our politics is concerned. I started writing an article for Front Page. Actually, I submitted an article for American Currency Magazine. I'm waiting for it to be published. And it's my contention that you cannot be a good parent if you're not involved in politics. And I want you to think about it. As parents, and I have 4 wonderful kids, I'm really, really blessed. I'm very fortunate. I'm very proud of my 4 children. But if you're a good parent, you know, you're very careful to take care of your child, prenatal care for the mom and all the right care for the baby and the well checks. And when they start to walk, we childproof the house and we teach them to look both ways before crossing and we get them whatever they need to do their schoolwork successfully. And we make sure that they're careful. And we do everything we can to be good parents and raise them. And then we spend money on their education. And they go to college, and you really hope and pray that they're going to come out of school with a good grade, with a good, useful degree, so they can have a bright future. And increasingly, that American kid with that college education isn't guaranteed the future that our generation would have been guaranteed. We are undermining our own workers, our own students, with this massive influx of foreign workers, foreign students. On the one hand, we're told, hey, you know, we got to bring in foreign workers because the American schools aren't capable of cranking out engineers, scientists, and technicians. Until, that is, foreign students enroll in our schools, and then the very next thing you hear is we need to staple green cards onto the diplomas of the foreign students. That is such a massive disconnect, it blows my mind. So as parents, we need to look at that and say, wait a minute. I've taken care of my children so they could have a bright, safe, successful future. So they could, as my parents would have said, so that you can have what I didn't have growing up, and hopefully your kids will do even better. Well, guess what, folks? Today, it's expected that the current generation will not do nearly as well as their parents. That's a first for America. We're going in the wrong direction. When we hear all this talk about income equality and income inequality, and Greenspan started this nonsense, everyone is presuming that what they're talking about is boosting the salaries of the middle class because the wealthy are making outrageous amounts of money. You know, I'm a big fan of free enterprise. Government has no place in setting salaries for the CEOs of companies. Minimum wage, I absolutely agree with. But CEOs, that's a whole other story. But what's happening today is that the salaries that CEOs earn are generally established by the board of directors, and all of these characters sit on each other's board of directors. So you vote for me, and I vote for you. It's collusion. I think what I would like to see, and I wonder what you folks think, and you can contact me through my website, michaelcutler.net, but what I'd love to see is a change in procedure so that the remuneration, the salaries of CEOs, isn't established by the board of directors, but by the shareholders, So there's no more collusion. You don't have the president of company A going to the CEO of company B and saying, you know, I really want to get rid of that Learjet, and I want them to buy me a Gulfstream 5. And his buddy from company B says, yeah, I'll vote for that, but I want a $25 million pay raise. Will you vote for me? Because if you do, I'll vote for you. And that's how it's being done today. Today, corporate CEOs very often make more than 500 times what their employees earn. 30 years ago, it would have been 50-something times. That money is coming out of those companies. It's not being paid to the workers who are busting their tails. It's not being given back to the investors who invested their money in the company with the hope of making a couple of bucks. And that money is not being put back into the companies to help those companies stay modern, productive, and effective and efficient. So that money, as far as I'm concerned, is legalized embezzlement. But what do I know? But the point of the matter is that as responsible parents, we need to look at all of this that's going on and say to ourselves, what future will my children have if we continue to allow the politicians to steal our future and our dreams? If you dare use the word alien today, the open borders anarchists will jump all over you. Oh, my God, that's hate speech. Oh, my God, how dare you? But do you realize that the term alien simply means any person, not a citizen or national of the United States? It's Orwellian. It's absolutely Orwellian, and it's done to obfuscate the issue, and it's done to put everybody on the defensive, and it's done so they could then say, well, if you don't want everybody who wants to come here to come here, and they're all immigrants, then you're anti-immigrants. And it comes back again to the fact that in a debate, control of the language is essentially the same as control of the high ground for the military. Control the language, control the debate, don't allow your opponent to define you. And when someone attacks you, stand your ground. You know, the stand your ground law where firearms is concerned, well, that's not what I'm talking about. It's a stand your ground law where the debate about immigration or any other political issue is concerned. Stand your ground and tell people who you are and what you stand for. So when someone says to me, you're an anti-immigrant xenophobe, I'm not going to walk away and say, oh, I'm sorry. Because that's what people are doing too damn often. And we have taught our adversaries that if they make the accusation, we will fold up like a cheap suit. It's got to stop. Work with your friends. Work with your neighbors. Understand the risks that we're running. Understand the tactics that our opponents are using. And, I mean, and that's really what it's supposed to be about. There's a wonderful quote from George Orwell, by the way, about the use of language. And I thought this was really terrific. And he wrote this in 1946. And it's entitled Politics in the English Language, George Orwell. Political language, and with variations, this is true of all political parties from conservatives to anarchists, is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable and give an appearance of solidity to pure wind. Pure wind. Hot air would be more like it. Lauren Martell was wonderful to join us this evening. especially since we pulled her away from a party. And down in Hilton Head, where she lives, they have some pretty awesome parties. But, you know, the point that I'm trying to make and that she was trying to make is this necessity for Americans to get involved and not come up with this hopeless and helpless deal of, oh, I'm just one person, I can't do anything. You'd be amazed about what one person can do. And just realize that every flood starts with that first drop of rain. One drop by itself is nothing, but by the time you add all those droplets up, and, you know, we are a country of more than 300 million Americans, and there's only 535 members of Congress in both houses. We certainly have them outnumbered. Something for you to think about. The election's coming. Make your voices heard. It's vital. Talk to your neighbors. Get out there. Like the lottery. You got to be in it to win it. It's really vital that you do these things. This is what our country is about. And this is how you offset those campaign contributions made by the various special interest groups who are trying to steal our future from us and, more significantly, from our children. Go to the CAPSWeb.org website. They have some really great articles up there. They're even running radio ads in California and the area around the West Coast, trying to wake people up. If you know people in California, tell them to go to that website and listen to the radios. Listen to the radios out there. You'll hear the CAPSWeb.org commercials. And spread the information around. You know, I always like to write about creating a bucket brigade of truth. That is my goal. So that being said, folks, I want to thank all of you for having spent this Friday, August 29th, with me, at least for an hour and almost a half. I look forward to joining you again next week at the same time here on the Michael Cutler Hour. Hope you all have a wonderful Labor Day weekend. And I want you all to remember, democracy is not a spectator sport. Get involved, folks. Get a hold of your politicians. I am sure they are lonely and just can't wait to hear from you. Good night, everybody.